know who's on the other end right now, but I will. Please say hi after the morning is over. If you are on Zoom, I can see people coming in, and it's wonderful to see everybody here today. You know, we are unable to practice together in the flesh. There's something special about practicing together, about sitting together. Anybody who's come to our evening sits or our Saturday sits knows there's a kind of collective energy that comes from practicing together. If you've gone to Sesshin, you know, there's Sesshin is this amazing experience where people come together for many days and practice for 8 hours a day, and that collective energy is extraordinary. And so now, you know, we're all under quarantine and we're living by ourselves pretty much. Some of us are in a house that we share with others. Some of us are by ourselves. And it makes that kind of practice impossible right now. But, you know, the Zen spirit, right? The Zen spirit is to do something about it, right? Reality is flexible. Reality is always flexible. We think it's fixed, but it's never fixed. So, you know, even though it might seem impossible that we could practice together, you know, there's computers, there's Zoom. We've been using Zoom for meetings. There's Facebook, you know, and you can put those together in a way that allows practice to happen. And it's wonderful, you know. It's wonderful that everybody can be here this morning. And let me just say that we're actually planning an online Sesshin. We're going to do our Sesshin. We're going to make some adjustments to the schedule. But we're actually planning to do it online, just a little bit, just like this morning, only all day, basically. And if you are at home and you are available in about 2.5 weeks, please think about attending Sesshin. This might be a wonderful time. You know, if you are not committed in some way, this is a chance to deepen your life. It might not be what you imagined. Right? It might not be quite the way we wanted to go to Sesshin. You know, we have our lovely place in South Jersey, Murray Grove. Whenever I go there, I feel this incredible. We've been going there for a long time, more than a decade, almost 2 decades. And you know, where I go in, drive in the parking lot, and you know, usually there's all these beautiful flowers. You know, I feel that aura of Sesshin. You know, dropping body and mind and becoming one with the 10,000 things is a beautiful, beautiful experience. You know, that's not possible, but we're going to do something else. And it's very important, you know, to realize that we have these resources that we don't necessarily assume we have. You know, anyway, I'm getting into the Teisho and I haven't even gone to the koan yet, so let me do first things first. Today's Teisho is in the Hikigan Roku, the Pien Lu, case 92. The world honored one takes his seat. Engo's introduction. One string is plucked and he discerns the whole tune. Such insight is hardly to be met with in 1,000 years. Like a hawk pursuing the hare, he at once demonstrates his superiority. He embodies all the teachings in one glance, encompasses the 1,000 great worlds in a single grain of dust. Can any of us go with him, living the same life and dying the same death? Can we testify to the truth by going through it ourselves? See the following example. Main subject. The world-honored one day took his seat on the platform. Manjushri struck the table with the gavel and said clearly, understand the Lord of Dharma's law. The Lord of Dharma's law is like this. the world honored one descended from his seat. Seth chose verse, the brilliant ones among the constellation know the Lord of Dharma's law is not like this. Had Sandhava been there, Manjushri need not have struck the gavel. So we're all apart, but we're all together in at least one way, in many ways, but in at least one way, we're all together. And that is we're alone in quarantine. I was just talking to a friend of mine, Jackie, who is one of the assistant directors in the writing program that I work in. And one of her students had made a TikTok video and posted it. And it was about being in quarantine. And it was so intelligent and sensitive. And at one point in the video, she looks out the window and she sees somebody in the street. And she goes out the front door and she's on her front porch. But when she gets outside to greet the person, the person is already gone. So she's alone again in her house. And I thought, you know, it was so skillfully done and it was so poignant, you know. It's so, such an expression of where we are now. And, you know, at Rutgers, we have not had class since spring break. We've been learning how to teach class a totally different way. I myself love being in a classroom. I either as a student, I enjoy being in a classroom as a student, and I enjoy being in a classroom as a teacher. I love that interaction with other people. You know, I've taken, you know, I don't even know how many courses I've taken on my way through graduate school, but you know, I would come into a class and it's a table full of strangers. And, you know, halfway through the semester, just talking to people, I learned so much about the world and so much about them. You know, I think I learned as much from the other people in my seminars in graduate school as I did from the professors. You know, the insights people bring just in conversation is so wonderful. And it's so spontaneous. You know, you whatever the discussion is for the day, you know, you have to read something to discuss, but, you know, actually you could never predict where the conversation is going to go. And it's like magic. It's so, so magical to have conversations like that. And I miss that. I have to say, you know, let me just say that we've been experimenting with the sutra group, the sutra study group on every other Sunday night. So the next one is not this Sunday, but the following Sunday, we're reading the Diamond Sutra. So if you would like to participate in the sutra study group, it's on the same meeting address, same meeting number, and same meeting password as today's event. So feel free to join. And it's okay. It's going pretty well. I mean, with Zoom, people can talk, see people speak, but it's not quite the same. It's not quite the same spontaneous magic. Coming into a classroom and having a conversation, especially if it goes well, you know, as a teacher, I try to orchestrate interesting conversations. And when they don't work, they don't work. But when they work, it's magical. Everybody's comes alive. And that's, those are the, as a teacher, those are the moments I live for. And sometimes they even carry over into the papers and I can remember the conversations that are present in the paper, you know. But all of that is gone, and who knows when it will come back. You know, this spring break, I had to learn how to teach online. And that's how I discovered Zoom. And Rutgers also has a Zoom-like product called Big Blue Button that I would recommend nobody try. It's a disaster. There's also WebEx, which works pretty well also. And there's a number of other programs that I learned how to use over. Zoom, and you can divide people into groups and they can discuss. You can also have people enter from the waiting room in Zoom, one after another. And so, you know, I'm learning how to use this new format for teaching. I have to say that I look back sometime and I think I can't wait to get back in the classroom, but who knows when we're going to get back into the classroom. I've been missing the classroom, and I've been missing the face-to-face, but, you know, this is something new, and it's actually got many interesting and positive qualities, as it does today. You know, some people have been attending our SIDS who are thousands of miles away. I don't know if Zafir is here today, but he started sitting with us more than a decade ago here in this room in Lucy Stone Hall. And then he went back to Turkey, and then his job has taken him to London. And he's been tuning in. And Rachel, I think she's out in the Northwest now, if I'm not mistaken. And she's been attending, you know. So many people who have been far away have been showing up, and that's really wonderful. I think when we go back to being able to sit together physically, we should have the computer set up so people who can't make it can participate. So there's something, there's some advantages to this new technology, you know, but still, I long for the face-to-face, you know, and I think probably all of us are sort of longing for what we had. I had a challenging week this week, you know. The thing about working at home is there's no boundaries, right? So you can start working at 7 in the morning and work until 8 at night, even later, you know. So I was really busy this week. I have a lot to do. This is the end of the semester, papers to grade, online conferences with students, and then all this other stuff going on, you know. So, last night I sat down and I said, you know, I would just love after the Saturday sit tomorrow to just go and have lunch at Sukh Sagar, you know, a delicious Indian meal. It would be so great. And then I realized I can't go to Sukh Sagar, you know, that's out of the question. You know, maybe they'll do curb pickup. I don't know. I haven't tried. And, you know, they just opened the parks, but for weeks and weeks, I was pining for the opportunity to go, you know, just get in my car and drive to the Delaware River and go for a long afternoon walk along the canal. You know, oh, that would be heaven, right? And gone. So, you know, definitely things I did, not just individual things, but sequences of things are disrupted. You know, the other day, my wife's greenhouses, she runs greenhouses for Union County College, they've all been closed. And so she's been at home, and she's been doing a lot of gardening at home, but she definitely misses her job. And it feels weird, right, not to have to get up and get to the greenhouse. And, you know, she's lost track of time. I mean, I'm still teaching online, and so, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are still meaningful. But she said to me the other day, what day is it? You know, I don't even know what day it is. And that's interesting, right? I mean, she's getting up at a totally different time. She doesn't know what day it is. And this is quite common. You know, lots of people are going through this experience. I'm going to the grocery store with my mask on and my gloves and buying food, you know, in a way I never did before. Usually I would go to the grocery store after the evening sit, you know, so I would do my grocery shopping after we sit here at the university and go to ShopRite on Centennial Avenue and buy my groceries and take them home. Now I actually get up, meditate, and then I go straight to a different ShopRite at like 7:30 when they open it up. They have like a special time for seniors in the morning, and there's actually, you know, like oranges and things are still available. You can get lettuce, and it's great. So I'm shopping at a different time. People I know are sort of in limbo, and this can be disconcerting. You know, I was reading the other day that many psychiatrists and psychologists are really afraid that at the end of this, or in the middle of this, there's going to be a mental health crisis. Because, people are, I was reading an article, and this one psychiatrist or psychologist said, you know, being at home day after day after day by yourself is like a formula for depression. I'm very much an introvert, so, you know, it's probably the case that my life has not changed that much. But I can definitely see many people, like my wife, who's very extroverted. She's not depressed, but definitely she feels she's missing things. And she's spending a lot of time on her phone, and she's FaceTiming people and so on. But I still think it's disruptive, and maybe for some people this is a very difficult place to be. I think this possibility of like a mental health crisis, loneliness, lots of people now have lost their job, and I hope, I'm sure that some people who are listening to this today show have lost their job. That's very wrenching, and I have been doing a lot of work in my office, and I love going to my office. I still have an office because I still have a job, and it's funny. Sometimes I've just so much hated going to the office. You know, it's like, oh man, I have to go into the office again. Now it's like, I can't wait to go to the office. It's an office. It's quiet. You know, it's a wonderful place now. So everything's changing in our lives. People are good and bad, right? I mean, in my town, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, an unheard of thing has happened. You know, I'll go for a jog because I get up, meditate, work, and then around five, I can't stand it anymore, and basically go out for a jog. And when I go out for a jog, these people, I've been living in this neighborhood for 20 years, people I have never seen are out walking. They're like families out walking, couples out walking, individuals out walking or running. And it's wonderful. You know, everybody's getting out of the house and they're actually outside. They can't talk to each other. But it's a change, right? And how many, I've lived there for 20 years and I've often gone running at that time and seen no one, you know, So things are changing, the schedules are breaking down, and something new could take its place if, you know, we don't hold on too much to the past. You know, in Zen teaching, in the sutras, there's a wonderful phrase that's so helpful. It's the phrase in English is habit energy, habit energy. And the sutra, the couple sutras, the Lankavatara Sutra, which I've spoken about and recommend very highly, also the Sharangama Sutra, both use this phrase, habit energy. And, you know, habit energy is basically karma, right? If you were raised to be on the spot, if your parents were very demanding of you, they expected perfection, right? Or they made it known that they were unhappy when your grades weren't good or something weren't really very good. You know, it's possible you became sort of like a workaholic. You know, that definitely happened to me in high school. I studied a lot in high school, more than I had to, because my parents really made it clear that I wasn't measuring up. So, you know, I just like studied from dawn till dusk, and I got really good grades, but I didn't really make any friends in high school because I didn't have time for friends. I was just studying. And I think, you know, when I look back on it, I realize that that kind of like constant work was the way I dealt with all kinds of anxieties, right? So, you know, I didn't have friends in high school. I was lonely, but I didn't really deal with my loneliness. I didn't allow myself to experience my loneliness. I just threw myself into my work. And, you know, I didn't date anybody in high school. Until I got to college, I never had a date because I didn't have time. I was studying all the time. And, you know, I was a teenage workaholic, right? I used work to cope with or to mask other problems. So my parents were getting a divorce. I just worked real quick. You know, I didn't pay any attention. I just worked. Study, you know? And so, when I got out of high school and I went to college and I got out of college, I got to know my brother and sister who I hadn't really got to know. So this is karma. Right. You know, I created an energy habit. Right. And that energy habit was difficult to break out of. You know, one of the things that got me out of my energy habit was nature. You know, I joined the Boy Scouts, or I was signed up for the Boy Scouts. And the Boy Scouts were a total waste of time from the standpoint of academics. Right. You don't get good grades for being in the Boy Scouts. You don't really learn anything that's quantifiable. It doesn't help you on the ACT or the SAT test. And so, you know, I was very reluctantly a Boy Scout, and I never made it past a second-class scout. But being out in nature was really an eye-opener for me. And it made me, it was liberating. Right? It was like getting away from the study, getting away from the books, being out in nature, going for a walk, you know, maybe for days, you know, going for like a hike. We went on a 50-mile hike when I was in the Boy Scouts. And that was so wonderful. So, you know, actually, that was another energy habit that I formed, right? And so, you know, all my life I've been a hiker, and I actually follow the same, pretty much the same ritual now that I followed when I was, you know, 18 years old or 16 years old. So, you know, we create our lives by creating these habit energies or energy habits, right? They're like feedback loops we create in our lives, you know, and we repeat. And the more we repeat, the more real it becomes. Right? So the first time I went on a hike, it wasn't real. I had been signed up for the Boy Scouts by my father. And, you know, he said, you need to get out of the books and you need to do something else. And with great reluctance, I agreed to go on this hike. And it was like eye-opening for me and wonderful, but nothing was expected or predictable. You know, I had never done anything like this before. But it became an energy habit. You know, I had a first time I ever had a backpack, first time I ever slept on a sleeping bag. You know, I still have a backpack and a sleeping bag, right? And now I have a better one than I did back then. But when I go hiking, it's a hike, right? It's a hike. And my friends, I have friends who are hikers, and we'll meet in Colorado and we'll go on a hike. I'll say, let's go on a hike. How many days? And there's trail food you can buy and so on, you know, and we have little cooking stoves and things like that. So it's real because we've made an energy habit out of it, you know, and what's true for, well, basically English professors. You know, there are English professors who spend their whole lives reading poetry and writing books about poetry. Now, when you think about it, that's a strange thing. But the whole society, you know, we've had English professors who write books on poetry for more than 150 years. In fact, you know, some of the greatest thinkers in the English language have been poets. Why do we treat poetry as real? Because as a culture, we've created energy habits around poetry, energy habits around reading literature. So, you know, the world is actually not structured. It's understructured, you could say. It doesn't have a kind of structure. In the Shorangama Sutra, it actually says, it's just continuous change. The reality is continuous change. And this is not so different from what the Buddha said. The historical Buddha said, first noble truth is that everything is impermanent, right? The Buddha put it that way. Everything is impermanent. And the Shorangama Sutra is a little different. It says it's just continuous change, and we pretend that it's not. It's like a roaring river, but we create eddies. You know, we put a rock in the river, and it creates a place where the water calms down. And those are our energy habits, and they create stability for us, right? And they reassure us, but they're totally arbitrary and imaginary. They're arbitrary and imaginary. But the more we repeat them, the more real they seem. You know, so everything is like this. You know, whole cultures are like this. So look, millions of people in the tri-state area get up on a weekday, and a weekday is an energy habit or a habit energy, right? There is no such thing as a weekday, right? We've invented weekdays. And you know, there are billions of people on Earth who never heard of a weekday. It's something we invented. You know, on Monday morning, your alarm clock goes off, you jump in your car, and you drive to work. And, you know, and then you work for your 8 hours. Maybe you have a lunch, contractually obligated lunch break, you know, that your union has worked out for you. And maybe you don't. But the point is, you go through the day every day, and it seems totally real. And then you go home, you drive home in your car, and there's the traffic, and you get home, and there's going to be dinner now, and then maybe you watch TV, and that seems like reality. But there's nothing real about that except habit. It's the habit energies. It feels real. Because we've inhabited those patterns of behavior over and over again. And the more you do them, the more real they become. And in fact, the more difficult it becomes to change. I mean, difficult becomes to change, you know. So everything, the Shorangama Sutra says, is energy. It happened. Energy happened. You know, the world is continuous change, but we use habits to create like little eddies of stable water, you know, little pools of stability in our lives. And as a culture, we do the same thing. And this is good, but it's also limiting, right? Because it's hard to change. It becomes harder and harder to change. And we become afraid of change. In fact, even if our energy habits, our habit energies, cause us great anxiety, we don't question that. We compensate for them. So a classic example would be something like, if you're stressed at work and you're working at home and you're stressed, you know, you might feel terrifically stressed and tense, and what you might do then is go downstairs and snack. Right? I'll have a snack. And when you're eating, it relieves you from the pressure, the emotional pressure of all the stress you're feeling. And it's a reward, right? Food tastes good. You know, And so pretty soon you're snacking all the time, and you get on the scale and you realize, oh my, how's this happening? You know, I'm only eating two meals a day, but you're creating another energy habit to deal with the one you already have, right, that creates all these problems. And another good one is people smoke in response to stress, right? So, you know, if you're highly stressed, you know, smoking is made for you. You know, I'm not a smoker, but so many people in my family are smokers, and most of them now have passed away from cancer, but seriously. But, you know, I know my father and my grandfather loved to smoke, and they were hard workers, and, you know, they rewarded themselves for their hard work by having a cigarette. You know, so my grandfather was an engineer who basically worked as a machinist, you know, after the Depression. And, you know, he would work hard, and then he would take a cigarette break, and he would look forward to that break. And, you know, he would stop, and he had his cigarettes ready, and he had his brand, and he'd light the cigarette. You could see him inhaling and exhaling this wonderful smoke. And this is what killed him. But it was an energy habit he created to deal with another energy habit, right? So, you know, what's happening to us now as individuals is traumatic in a lot of ways. And it's frightening also, not just as individuals, but the culture, because, you know, people are saying now we may never go back to being what we were. And I think that our Zen training should be helping us at this time, you know, because, you know, we know how to go back to zero. We know how to go back to zero. That's like the most wonderful thing in the world, right? You know, when things are falling apart, when the ground is shifting under your feet, it's quite understandable that people will try to restore what they had, try to go back, or they'll be consumed by longing for what they had. Or they'll just look for a new energy habit, right? So where are those cigarettes? But you know, we Zen people know how to go to zero. You know, we know how to go to zero. And when you sit down on the cushion and you enter deep mushin, deep emptiness, you know, it gives you, I think, a different perspective on the things around you. For one thing, I think it's easier to see how arbitrary things are. You know, in psychoanalytic literature, there's something called derealization. Derealization, and usually that's spoken of in a very negative way. So when therapists are talking about patients who are delusional, they say, you know, there's derealization going on. Right, and they're distancing themselves from reality, and they're creating like fantasies, basically. But actually, derealization is not a bad thing in itself. It's actually very valuable. You know, if you go to Sesshin, for example, and you come back to Sesshin from Sesshin, you know, you may notice that your life is unreal to you suddenly. You know, you suddenly realize, you know, this is all rather unreal. And sometimes when you're sitting on the cushion too, you know, you get off the cushion and you get on the bus or you drive to the shop, right? And suddenly, you know, you're struck by the kind of unreality of this. And that might be a frightening insight, but it's actually precious insight because it is unreal. You know, there are people who think that getting up at 7 o'clock, getting your job by 9, putting in your egg, that is reality. That is reality. But that is not reality. That is a collective dream. Now, I'm not putting it down because it's all a dream, right? It's all arbitrary. But, you know, if we believe too hard in the collective dream, we become prisoners of that dream. And if we learn how to go to zero, right, we know how to avoid getting trapped in these habit energies trapped by our own habit energies. You know, so many people, I've had many Zen students over the years who gave up smoking, for example, since we're on the subject of smoking. You know, and smoking is not a moral evil, right? It's not a bad thing. If you want to smoke, please enjoy your smokes. But, you know, many people in the course of their Zen practice give up smoking because they realize that they don't need it anymore, right? It's like I've been compensating myself. I am feeling some kind of a need that I haven't met or haven't filled, and I don't know what it is, so I'm having a cigarette, right? I'm feeling something that makes me uncomfortable, and I don't know what it is. And I have a cigarette, and suddenly, you know, when I have that cigarette, that nicotine hits me, and I feel alive for a little while, and then I go back to work. So, you know, it's quite commonly the case that people in Zen practice at some point, you know, they'll be working with a koan. And you know, there's the koan about being on a solitary peak, right? You know, sitting alone on the solitary peak. People work with that koan, and like any koan, it produces many different responses. But one of the responses it can produce is that some people suddenly realize that they're very lonely. They're alone on a mountain peak. And they see their habit energy. And they realize, you know, I don't want to be like, I don't want to be solitary. I need to go make some friends, you know. And they'll come into the Dokusan room and say, you know, I realize I've got to make some friends. You know, I've cut myself off because I'm afraid of people judging me, right? And I'm going to go make some friends. And if I make some friends, they're probably going to judge me, but it's okay, you know. And then, you know, maybe in a Dokusan subsequently, somebody will come in and say, by the way, I don't know why, but I've just given up smoking. See, being able to go to zero is like the most liberating thing in the world, because the more we repeat our habit energies, the more real they become. They become so compelling. These are compulsive, they become compulsive behaviors, right? But practicing the brave way, entering Mushin, allows us to get some distance on our energy habits, to depersonalize, which sometimes is a negative term, and derealize, right? And when you depersonalize and you derealize, that's not necessarily pathological, it's liberating. You suddenly realize, and in fact, dissociation is liberating, right? You know, our society is a very delusional society. So being a little bit dissociated could be an extremely good thing, right? So you know, if one day you're dissociated, you realize that the values of your society are quite unhealthy. You know, that's a wonderful thing if you have the confidence to act on your insights. And that's another thing that Mushin gives you. You know, when you go into deep Mushin and insight is coming from a very deep place in yourself. It's not like reading a self-help book, right? It's coming from a very deep place in yourself. You know, many years ago, I had a chance to work with a Zen teacher who had some problems. He fell short in terms of his ethical behavior. And, you know, he had a beautiful temple up in the mountains, and I won't say where, but he definitely he invited me to be his second in command when I was quite young. And, you know, this place was so beautiful, and it had a big endowment, and it had hundreds of students, probably thousands of people went through there every year. But, you know, there was something about this guy that just didn't ring true to me. That didn't seem right. And I did talk to my teachers. I talked to Genki and I talked to Webb, but, you know, really I had to make the decision myself. So, you know, I went to a sesshin, and, you know, there was a part of me that said,